This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Dominating right circle, Suzuki. Low now to Demidov. Side of the net, in front. One-timer from Suzuki, knocked down and kept to the outside. Demidov continues. 1:38 left and a glove save made by Logan Thompson. The shot from Suzuki, a one-timer from one knee, and Thompson says, I got this. 1:36 left. It's still 3-1 Washington.
John Walton, at the end of last night's game, when they pulled the goaltender, there was a lot of pressure on Logan Thompson. He held up. They got an empty netter at the end. They won the game 4-1. Listen to this. Logan Thompson, 28 stops on 29 shots faced per Money Puck. All right, Money Puck, I guess a stat hockey service. He saved 2.99 more goals than expected. That is elite. He was outstanding during the series, and he got hurt during the series. A big series from him. Certainly a big series from Alex Ovechkin, who ended up with 4 goals. Dylan Strom had another 2 points last night, assisting on Ovechkin's goal and Tom Wilson's goal that made it 3-0. Strom now with 9 points in the postseason, ties him for second most in the league. The only players ahead of him are Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, and Adrian Kempe, all involved in the Edmonton LA Kings series. Of course, Ovechkin's 4 goals right now, really good, not tops in the league through the postseason so far. Some of these teams have played 6 games, Washington just 5, but he's second in goals scored in the postseason. And last night's goal, his 76th career playoff goal, tying him with Mario Lemieux for 12th on the all-time list. You would certainly think, if the Caps hadn't lost as many times as they did early in the postseason, first round or second, that he'd be much higher up on the all-time playoff goal list. Still has some time to go, including several games in this series. Washington with their first ever win over Montreal in the postseason, only the second time they ever faced Montreal. That first time was that Yaroslav Halak series back in 2010, when the Caps were the President's Trophy winning team. And they've never beaten Carolina in the postseason either. However, they've only played Carolina once as well heading into this series. So maybe two sort of revenge series back-to-back. They lost to Carolina in a 7th and deciding game at home in 2019 as the defending Stanley Cup champs. You know, one other thing to mention about the game that we have not mentioned on the show yet today: Alexei Protas made his postseason debut. He was on the ice for close to 17 minutes. No goals, no assists. Just reading some of the stuff from the post-game thoughts from many of the hockey people out there. They thought he looked a little bit, you know, rusty, but still good to have him back. Big win for Washington. First series win since 2018. Game one against Carolina comes Monday night against at Capital One Arena. Caps with home ice advantage, but they are the underdog in the series.
That fourth line, by the way, they were given, because Carbs was matching them up against Montreal's top line with Slavkovsky, Suzuki, and Gallagher and all them. They shut him down. Like, they just
Alexei
stymied
Protas is on that fourth line, right?
He was last night, yes.
Yeah.
And they just...
What line is he usually on?
First, top Ovi, line? He's usually... Ovi, Strom, Protas has been a line throughout most of the season that has been really successful. Protas gives him a lot of size. Strom and Ovi... Strom is just Nick Backstrom reincarnated. And Ovi's Ovi. So that line has been performing very well throughout most of the season. And with that injury coming back, he's starting to work in. But that they that size and the defense that that fourth line played last night just shut him down.
The guy that I actually am very impressed with, and I'm only watching pretty much for the first time, although I did see him in one of the games in which Ovi was chasing down Gretzky. I think I saw the first game, his debut after, you know, having a great season at Boston College. But Ryan Leonard, man, is
awesome.
Fast and energetic. And to me, it looks like it's only a matter of time. I think the only goal he had was an empty netter.
Yes, correct.
Right?
The same night Ovi tied Gretzky, yeah.
Exactly. But he looks like he's going to score a goal or two coming up. Don't
you
think or not?
He almost had one last night, man. He was driving to the net, just driving hard, couldn't get the puck through, and then just tripped right over the leg of Dobesh. Did his Bobby Orr impression. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, they seems like it's a good team and a hell of a series coming up. Wyshynski, who was on with us earlier from ESPN, you can listen to that when the show is over at theteam980.com or by downloading the Odyssey app. He likes Washington in the next series, but he really likes Florida to get to the Stanley Cup Finals. But, you know, like we talked about at the Open, I think in many ways, the expectations for this season have already been overcome. That doesn't mean that once you get to the postseason, it feels like icing on the cake. But I'll tell you this, the getting by the first round, I think, was huge. When I had Ted on recently, and I've had him on twice in the last three or four months, in talking about sort of the length of time that it had been since the Stanley Cup, you know, you could sense that he understood that a first-round loss would not look good for anybody. And I think getting through Montreal is a heavy favorite to get through Montreal. And a Montreal team that was up for the fight, they just weren't as good, is a big relief. And now maybe they can play with a little bit of, you know, the feeling of there's not much to lose now. You know, they want to advance and continue to move on. Remember, the series for them in 2018 was the Pittsburgh series. Getting by Pittsburgh was the 10,000-pound gorilla on their back. And getting to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time, out of the second round for the first time during the OV era. They did that, and the Tampa series felt like, okay, whatever happens, happens. I'm not suggesting the players felt that way. But this is a series that they're an underdog in, and they didn't crap the bed in this postseason by getting through the first round. And by getting through the first round in just five games. You know, this was not a sweat-it series, really, at any point. Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you much about Carolina and the Caps heading into it, but we will have plenty of people on between now and Monday that will be able to tell you more, including Max.
They're young and they're fast. That's what I can tell you.
All right. All right, so yesterday, or really 2 days ago, was the beginning of kind of the post-draft, let's look ahead to 2025 power rankings season. I had already mentioned, I think, on Monday's show that Washington's over-under in a lot of places actually dropped after the draft. It was either 9.5 or 10.5, depending on where you looked. But in the spots that it was 10.5, it actually dropped to 9.5 after the draft. I would suggest that it's because they only had five picks, and Philadelphia had many more, and Washington didn't get their number one need or perceived need by the outside, that being a pass rusher or an edge-setting, run-stopping defensive end. And so, you know, the number dropped from 10.5 to 9.5. It'll still be the largest over-under win total number entering a season for this football team since 2000. They had a 10.5 win total that year and were a legitimate preseason Super Bowl pick behind the St. Louis Rams, who had won the Super Bowl the year before. St. Louis was actually the favorite to go to the Super Bowl that year. And Washington was like the third favorite to go to the Super Bowl that year and win the Super Bowl. But their over-under on wins was 10.5. This 9.5 will be the most heading into a season since 2000. And look, it's obvious. The expectations for the first time since we've been talking together over all of these years is the expectations are the highest they've been. I mean, you got to go back to 2000. The expectations were not super high entering 2006. I mean, they were higher because they had gone to the playoffs the year before. Joe Gibbs was entering his third year. Remember, they hired Al Saunders before that season in 2006 with his 300-play playbook, page playbook. But they still weren't anywhere near 9.5 or 10.5 wins. Wasn't that way coming off 2012 because of the injury to RG3. There was not a lot of confidence in this team coming off 2015's division title or 2020's division title, obviously, because they had won that division with a losing record. The expectations heading into this season are the highest they've been in a long, long time, even though the total did drop. So the power rankings are starting to come out. You know, the post-draft, still all too early and way too early, power rankings. So CBS Sports had Philly 1, Kansas City 2, the two teams that were in the Super Bowl. The Bills 3 and the Lions 4. The Bills were in the AFC Championship game. The Lions were not. Washington was. Baltimore 5, and then Washington. Clearly the highest spot they've been in before a season started in the what I would call the power rankings era. I don't even know when it began, but I would guess 15 years ago, something like that. That was CBS Sports. USA Today had Philly 1, had Baltimore 2, and then they actually valued a team that I've talked about a little bit since the season ended and since this team added Devontae Adams in particular. I thought the Rams were being shorted a bit too much by people who were doing all too early power rankings or even the odds makers. But USA Today had the Rams as the third best team in the NFL. I actually think the Rams look really good heading into 25. A really potentially very good football team. Kansas City's 4, Buffalo is 5, and Washington 6. So in two of the, you know, post-draft power rankings, Washington comes in at 6 on both lists. Now, how high did they get to last year? Did they get to 5, maybe, you know, late in the season, in the regular season? I don't think they got to top 5. I don't think they did. The way I would view the NFC right now is I would certainly make Philadelphia, if I were an odds maker, I would make Philadelphia the favorite. And understanding that, you know, their defense has changed. I don't know if it's going to be any worse. I'm not necessarily suggesting it'll be any worse, but it's changed. They lost some players, and they added some players. And, oh, by the way, they drafted in their first 5 picks defensive players. But I would make Philadelphia the favorite. I would then have a really close call between Detroit, Washington, and the Rams. I think the Rams look really good on paper heading into the season. I think they've got a chance to be a very good football team. You know, the key was they didn't make a change at quarterback. You know, there was the possibility that they weren't going to work out a deal with Matthew Stafford. How would that actually play out? But to add Devontae Adams, basically replacing Cooper Kupp, and Devontae Adams can still play and was still playing at a high level with Aaron Rodgers at the end of last year. To have him and Puka Nacua and Stafford and Kyron Williams, pretty good offensive line. They kept, remember, Alaric Jackson, re-signed him. And then that defense is young and nasty. I mean, you've got Jared Verse, you've got Braden Fisk, you've got, Witherspoon, you got Cam Curl, who played pretty well for them last year. I think the Rams are well coached. I think they've got the talent. And the key is just Matt Stafford staying upright and healthy. I actually think Philly should be the favorite. And I think that Washington, the Rams, and Detroit, you can put them in any order. should come next in the NFC. I think based on their regular season last year, but remember, they lost both coordinators. Both coordinators are gone in Detroit. But they're still, they should be, a lethal offensive team. And Aiden Hutchinson, we'll see what he looks like when he comes back. I like the Rams a lot on paper. The 49ers, a lot of people have odds makers wise right there with Detroit and Washington and the Rams. And a lot of people like the Packers heading into the season. I think Tampa's a little bit underrated in the NFC heading into the year. You know, they were right there with Washington with a chance to go on and play in the next round as well. I think Tampa's well coached. Baker Mayfield gets another new offensive coordinator after losing Liam Cohn to Jacksonville. But they've got talent. They added a receiver in the first round. I think that was a surprise for some people. You know, Godwin, Evans, and now Igbuka, who they added in the first round. They also added the guy from Oregon, Tez Johnson, in the draft as well. In free agency, a good defense, you know, added Hassan Reddick. The NFC's better than the AFC. The NFC's deeper than the NFC. You know, I don't know if we thought that going into the season last year. Philly, Washington, the entirety of the NFC North, including Chicago, Tampa, the Rams, the 49ers if they stay really healthy, and Seattle. I'm not a big Sam Darnold believer. I like Sam Darnold. I think that he, in the right system, Sam Darnold can do what he did last year. I still think ultimately you can't win it all with Sam Darnold. But the NFC is deeper than the AFC. The AFC is Kansas City, Baltimore, and Buffalo. Now, will Cincinnati be healthy and take a step up defensively and be a contender? You know, what does Houston look like? Are they going to, you know, have we seen what Houston is? They've got to improve their offensive line, and they traded Tunsil to D.C. What are the Chargers like? What's Denver like? But the NFC is really tough, man. I mean, Washington, Philly, Detroit, Green Bay, Minnesota, Chicago, Tampa, the Rams. You got a list of teams that are going to be legitimate contenders for the NFC title. And you know what happens in those situations. Comes down to how healthy do you remain? And do you win those 50-50 games? And do you catch teams at the right time? It's not who you play, it's when you play them. Which we will find out. 2 weeks from today, we will be talking about the schedule that had been released the night before on May 14th. Joe Maloney worked for the team and was the point guy on All Stadium Matters. He's no longer with the team, but he is intimately involved in what went down and what was announced Monday. You'll hear what he thinks about the city council and the likelihood that they will pass the deal the mayor did with the team next. But first, I want to mention this. If you've never been to a rugby match, this is the one to check out. Old Glory DC is a show. Serious intensity. The game features big hits, fast breaks, nonstop action. These guys are all over the field. The hits are loud. The energy in the stands is great start to finish. This Sunday, Old Glory's back home at the Maryland Soccerplex, taking on the Utah Warriors. Kickoff's at 2 p.m., and it's Kids' Day. It's a great day for the whole family. Inflatables, face painting, games, post-game autographs with the players. It's an incredible experience for the kids and the adults. By the way, one of those players played basketball for me. Hell of an athlete. Owen Sheehy is a really good player for Old Glory. I don't know if he's their best player because I haven't followed the team, but I'm rooting for Old Glory. Add in the weather Sunday, and you've got the perfect setup for an incredible Sunday outside. Whether you're a longtime rugby fan or just looking for something different and exciting, this is it. The hits are real, the action never stops, and the crowd makes it feel like a party from the moment you walk in. College man, rugby players, they threw great parties, the rugby team did. Get your tickets for Sunday now at oldglorydc.com. That's oldglorydc.com. Great rugby, great weather, and a great time for the whole family. Old Glory DC. Let's scrum together. All right, let's talk stadium and the D.C. City Council's job in a few months or less to hopefully approve what we heard about on Monday. Mayor Bowser and Roger Goodell and Josh Harris getting everybody excited about the team's return to D.C. and the RFK site. Joe Maloney was the VP of Public Affairs for the team, and he was the point person for the team on all of these stadium conversations over the years with Virginia, with Maryland, and with D.C. Now, Joe is not with the team anymore. He's now the senior VP of communications with the American Gaming Association. But a lot of the conversation we're having today is because of Joe. And I want to start with this. And it's kind of cutting to the chase because there's been a lot of conversation post Monday about certain city council members not being thrilled with the deal or not knowing enough about the deal. I'll ask you, was it premature on Monday to be as celebratory as the mayor and Josh Harris and Roger Goodell were about a return to D.C.?
There's several more very important steps to take place, but I do think the staging of that event was very intentional. And when you're in the type of work that involves creating a majority for the purposes of approving a specific type of package, it's important to generate enthusiasm, energy, demonstrate momentum, and get your story out there. So the event was intentional. It was done for those reasons. I would describe the event as an overall success, but history is littered with a lot of events such as these that have gone sideways, that become unfortunate artifacts in deals gone wrong. And we have seen it in other NFL cities that have had various episodic examples of these things going sideways. It begins with Governor Rowland in Connecticut holding up a jersey and handing it to Robert Kraft in the late 90s, to the various machinations in the Chicago Bears search, where they've done multiple events such as this one, and it hasn't worked out. But it was done, Kevin, with a high level of confidence that this deal is going to get done on the mayor's preferred timeline.
So let's talk about the deal that was described on Monday. How would you describe it, Joe? Would you describe it as a deal that is really good for the city more so than the team? A deal that's really good for the team more so than the city? Or is it a deal that's really good for both parties? For someone that isn't going to sit there and read through the entire term sheet, how would you describe it?
Largest and most historic private capital investment in the District of Columbia in a generation. A catalytic economic development engine for not only the 180-acre parcel in the surrounding community, but for the region. And then lastly, continuing to keep this region competitive as it relates to major, not just sporting events, but major global and cultural events. That this is an important deal for the city and for the club and for our sports economy, and it will yield significant economic dividends for the region.
Okay, but there seems to be certainly, you know, a lot of posturing maybe right now, but do you have a sense that the deal is one-sided either way, or is it just, you know, a fair deal through and through?
It continues a trend line, Kevin, that I think is really important in the overall discussion around investments, both private and public, in mixed-use sports entertainment districts. And that trend line continues to grow on the part of public investments. You go back to the Raiders Stadium, Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas, $750 million in public investments. You then go up to Buffalo, the state and county combined $850 million in public investments for that structure. And we go to Tennessee, Nashville for the Titans. That structure is close to about $1 billion in public investments. And now we're here with the district, whereby, based on press accounts, we're seeing up to $1.1 billion in public investment. That's happening, Kevin, because there is near universal agreement, and I understand there are academic critics on this, but there's near universal agreement that these destinations create a significant amount of economic activity that is absolutely not displacing other economic activity. It's adding economic activity. So I do think everybody wins. I truly do believe that. I think this is a good deal for the club. It's going to allow the club to continue to be competitive, as other teams have done in developing mixed-use entertainment, sports entertainment districts, a way in which they can capture revenue. And it also allows the city to capture tax revenue to continue to invest in communities that create multimodal, multi-use experiences for not just residents, creating housing and the like, but for additional international investment, inbound visitation, and other use purposes.
You said that Monday's announcement press event was very intentional. And I'm assuming, you know, what you meant was they intended to generate a ton of excitement, get fans super excited, get D.C. residents super excited, so that the D.C. council members who are lukewarm or even against it think about doing something that might be politically advantageous for them. What I'm wondering is, the D.C. council is going to ask the mayor to go back and haggle the deal, to get a better deal, so that they can say, hey, look what we did. We got involved and we got the city an even better deal than the mayor had negotiated. Where are those areas of the current, you know, term sheet, the current structure of the deal, where you think the city council is going to ask the mayor to go back and you know, haggle, for the lack of a better description?
Sure. And let me just put this in your love language, Kevin. I think the over-under on yes votes with the ultimate deal is somewhere around 10 right now. Okay?
Really?
And I do. I think this passes, and we can get into some of the specifics, but I would set it at 10 right now. 10 votes approving this investment on the part of the city and approving this overall package. Will this package change? Yes, absolutely. And we have our own examples here in D.C. with previous stadium structures that have changed dramatically when an agreement between the mayor, the executive, and the team move to the legislative body, the city council. So we can absolutely expect things to change. And those council members that have either voiced curiosity and an eagerness to roll up the sleeves and work on this, council members such as Zachary Parker, council member at large Christine Henderson, and just about an hour ago, council member Robert White, they're ready to lean in. They're trying to stay in the conversation, Kevin. You have Phil Mendelson, who's giving himself a lot of room to approve this. I know he has stated he's opposed to a stadium with public subsidy, but he's also leaving himself room as well. And I think there's basically two sort of deal points here, and there's two areas of haggle, to use your term. One, it could just be defraying the public investment and asking the team to contribute more in private investment. Okay? And then the second piece of this, okay, the other opportunity is to create opportunity for something that you believe to be important and included in the overall deal. That could be something as small as dedicated arts funding for magnet schools that are close by, to certain types of curb cuts and pedestrian safety measures that need to be incorporated, to a myriad of other things, to something perhaps much, much bigger, like the co-location of a job training center for district residents or for returning citizens to be able to be employed by the various businesses that are created, okay? But ultimately what it comes down to, I think, is this tension here, Kevin, between what is an appropriate amount of public subsidy and what do the taxpayers get in return that is not just necessarily economic activity or tax revenue, the things that the people running the numbers are spitting back out, but the things that you can see and that you can feel. So as I say, I went to graduate school and I learned two things after spending a lot of money to get a graduate degree. And one is that elected officials overwhelmingly first care about their own reelection. Okay. And then the second thing I learned is that elected officials, particularly those that haven't made up their mind, they don't necessarily like being confronted with what I call an aura of inevitability. And so there was a cohort of council members that were probably confronted with that feeling after Monday. I'm not ready to support this deal, so I'm not going to show up on Monday at the press club, okay? But what they're doing right now, Kevin, is they're giving themselves leverage to be in the room, to be a part of the ultimate negotiation, and they need to be judicious with that leverage, right? Because the club and the mayor only need 7 votes. I think they'll get more than that, for sure. But I think those individuals that are expressing the right type of curiosity, being cerebral about the process, wanting to learn more, are going to put in the work, I think are ultimately going to come along, because I think the mayor and the club are going to want this to be a 10, 11, 12 vote outcome, not a 7 vote outcome.
That second piece of, like, you know, renegotiation, haggling, you know, number one being just asking the team to contribute more. And part two being, you know, the co-location of some business or charter school, you know, whatever. You went through a list of things. Would that include potentially the team relocating its primary, you know, business operations and maybe its football operations to the actual, you know, new site?
Certainly might. I've heard some council members voice a concern that the business operations would remain in College Park. That's a business operation that is about 100 to 125 employees on any given day. Those are people that walk out of that office and generate commerce in that area of activity. It also is a little point of pride for a specific neighborhood community as well. I think that the club has derived an enormous amount of value out of its partnership in College Park and some of the adjacencies that it affords with the University of Maryland. I clearly could understand why council members and why district government would want those employees going to work every day in the District of Columbia. It increases the tax base, of course. I do not think that the club would necessarily be interested, nor the city for that matter, to create a practice facility for the football operations. I think there's just so much synergy and so much efficiency, particularly with land use out in Virginia, the proximity to Dulles Airport to get people in and out. I think it's perhaps a better environment for players to more conveniently live in a suburban community and have the ability to sort of move a family and what have you. And so I would be surprised if the football operations moved, but it also would not shock me, though, if the front office operations, your ticketing, your legal, your marketing, saw an opportunity to come into the district and that ended up being one of the deal components. I'm not saying that was remotely discussed when I was with the club, but it certainly is potentially a leverage point for a council member to use in a forthcoming negotiation.
All right, you set the over-under at 10. When does the vote take place? And would you bet over or under? Look, your under is going to still be a winner, meaning it's going to get approved, in your opinion. But when does this happen, and how many council members end up voting yes?
I believe there to be, I think, I'm optimistic. I would bet the over. I think it's somewhere around 11 to 12 votes, Kevin. I do think that this is such a catalytic, massive private investment. And I think the council members that are going about this the right way, that are thinking about this the right way, are going to have every opportunity to communicate with the club. And I think the mayor's team as well. This should not be a sort of poisoned and sort of toxic exercise. I think if this is going to have the type of, I think, generational impact, you're really going to want to sort of have as many folks as supporting as possible. And I think and truly believe Josh and the team and the mayor are invested in that outcome. And so I think they're going to do what it takes to get people on board. So I would absolutely be betting the over. If it is somewhere in that 7, 8, 9 sort of range, it just becomes a little bit too unpredictable. And I think the timeline might slide. Simply because you're going to potentially be in some protracted negotiation to sort of get this over the finish line if you're down to counting numbers that closely, which might just affect that timeline that was stated, I think, in some press materials that were handed out of July 2025. And I've heard reported that there's some clause about July 15 being a date
right.
that the team could walk away from the agreement. Yeah. But I just can't imagine an environment where that wouldn't be extended to accommodate some additional negotiations with a few recalcitrant council members.
So I want to know, and I think you know the answer to this, which of the two, D.C. or Maryland, will produce the better return on investment for the team? Because we've seen this $2.7 billion team investment number many times since Monday. You know the economics of what was going to happen in Maryland, in Landover, and what now has happened in D.C. Which was the better deal for the team? We know they want to be in D.C., but is it actually the deal that will produce a bigger return for them long term?
It's probably not fair to answer that quickly. And I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that this is a structure that I think would have been highly attractive in the region so long as it was located inside the Beltway. That I think a lot of the sort of international and the inbound visitation and the revenue opportunities could be realized with a structure anywhere inside the Beltway and its proximity to our three airports. Okay, let me just state that. However, I think the multimodal attractiveness, got a metro center here, you're 13 blocks from the U.S. Capitol, the sort of, once-in-a-lifetime type of structure and rendering that they put forward with views of the United States Capitol, I think the revenue opportunity is absolutely higher. I think the revenue per square foot is absolutely higher as it relates to just foot traffic, additional sponsorship opportunities. I think the sponsorship component, the stadium naming rights component, is significantly higher in a D.C. structure at RFK versus a structure in Maryland at Landover. And I just, when I talk to people about this project, I just say to them, just think of Monday Night Football and the drone shot and the blimp shot in the United States Capitol and the RFK in the same frame. And your company's name is on the top of that translucent roof. It's just, you cannot put a price tag on that. And so I just think it's a remarkable revenue opportunity. And yes, I think the return on equity, the return on investment would be either realized quicker, Kevin, or potentially much higher with this location versus others.
But the cost going in also much higher in D.C. than it would have been in Maryland.
The team investment
yes.
is higher in D.C. than in Maryland, correct? Yeah, I think Maryland would have other levers and other sort of tether opportunities when it came to state-generated revenue to create less costs for the club. Yes, absolutely. And Maryland has a terrific track record in that. I mean, Maryland Stadium Authority is one of the most highly respected financial facilities when it comes to structures such as stadiums and schools. And simply because there's multiple tethers. There's a mature Maryland lottery. There's gaming revenues. There's all types of sophisticated, financial tethering that can be done in a state such as Maryland. But, you know, D.C.'s also had a tremendous amount of success, too. The ballpark fee is second to none. Nats Park is an investment that's been paid for. It's realized enormous economic activity. It's a true success story in this country. So I'm confident the club and the city will be able to replicate that success with this parcel.
The league will contribute to this endeavor as well, correct? And how much?
It's $300 million, I believe, at last sort of public disclosure of that stadium funding program. But of course, you know, that money would ultimately end up being repaid in some form. And I can't recall the sort of revenue if it's ticket sales or if it's a portion of ticket sales, but ultimately that money then does get ultimately repaid to the league and its owners.
When you were talking about this, you know, and pitching it, and you know, having many a meeting about this, how much of the conversation was about the structure itself and the possibilities of beyond 8 or 9 home dates a year?
Oh, I think it's always been envisioned as, first of all, a structure with a roof, and second of all, a structure that could compete for the types of global events that the region has not been able or not necessarily been successful in landing, but also, you know, again, like year-round components, swing spaces for things like smaller conventions and larger corporate meetings, if you will, down to, you know, your concerts and your other larger programmed events. And so that has been a massive, massive, I think, component of both the vision for this structure under Dan and then the vision of the structure under Josh as well.
By the way, just to be clear, not a retractable roof, right? Because that's more expensive.
It's more expensive, and it's just generally not used as frequently as you might think. You get one quarterback that prefers it shut, it always stays shut.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's just not worth it.
All right. The Super Bowl will be played at the new stadium in what year?
I would say if it's not by 2032, then we should be stomping our feet. I think it'll be very early in the stadium's opening years.
I think I've asked you this before, but if I haven't, just the draft and the process to get the draft to D.C. I think is a more difficult one because of permitting. What do you know about that? Because Tommy seems to believe that the league, you know, with a new stadium downtown will look to, before it opens at some point, hold a draft here as well.
So in my post-employment life, Kevin, obviously my proudest moment was the federal bill passing. And just, again, having been part of something where I spent a lot of time on. The next proudest moment, Kevin, will be when the NFL declares that the draft is coming to the city. It's been a very long process. The club's committed to it. I know that the league, the city is committed to it. I know the league would love for it to happen. We'll find out. I think we were close under the Snyder ownership era, and then for a lot of reasons it didn't happen. But boy, that will be absolutely amazing. And the league, as you have seen with the production of the NFL draft over the last 2 to 3 cities, the league will spare no expense and will do an amazing job showcasing our city and our region. It's just going to be fantastic. I'm confident it'll happen. So hopefully we're in the mix here for, you know, I think 27, 28, 29.
Didn't you tell me, though, or somebody tell me that because it's federal land, because there's only one place to hold it, and that's down, you know, town on the mall, that the permitting process is just years in advance for an event this size, and that was one of the bottlenecks in getting it done?
It can be overcome, but you're talking about a multi-jurisdictional area of our city. I think it's something hilarious, Kevin. I honestly think for some intersections in and around the U.S. Capitol and the National Mall, you have a dozen different jurisdictional partners that you have to work with, whether it's U.S. Capitol Police, Park Police, D.C. Police. I mean, it's astonishing.
Right.
The amount of just the law enforcement piece of it is extremely, extremely complicated. So it's just not a permitting process that is, I go to the National Park Service, they stamp me approval for my protest, and a bunch of people show up and protest. Like, you know, that's a standard NPS permit situation, and that's not this. Simply because it will require an enormous amount of pedestrian and vehicular traffic, law enforcement exercises. So it's part of the process. But to do certain things on certain types of properties, there's a commercial restrictions as well, right? So you can't necessarily commercialize the National Mall. So if you're holding a function on the National Mall, you can't sell stadium beers and you can't have signs bigger than a certain amount of space for any types of specific brands, right? So there's a lot of things to jump through. And again, in a franchise such as the NFL draft, the league has a certain way of doing things, and partners to the NFL draft have certain expectations on brand promotion as well and brand activation. And so the league, the club, the city, the federal government, it's very, very complicated. So it will be an interesting ingredient mix when it finally happens. And I'm truly hopeful. I'm very confident it will happen. So that's why I say when, not if. When it does, it will be amazing. I'm sure you remember, I believe it was the fall of 03 when the NFL last activated on the National Mall, and it was a Thursday night game,
yeah.
Redskins versus Jets.
Jets.
If I remember, the yeah. Redskins won on a last-second field goal.
Yeah, by John
there
Hall.
There was, I believe, a Britney Spears concert.
Oh, was it Britney Spears? I remember it being a big production. This was before they used the defending Super Bowl champions in the Thursday night game, because obviously Washington was not a defending Super Bowl champion. But I do remember the game, and I remember there was a big NFL kind of buildup in D.C. to the game. Yes.
Yes. And so I will say there's some residual scar tissue from that exercise with NPS, because that rules were broken. There was consumption. Significant consumption of certain types of products.
Yeah.
There was significant promotion of certain types of products. And so there was definitely an agreement that, hey, maybe NPS and the NFL will take a little bit of a break for a little while. And again, you know, the mall is a very sensitive area, as you know.
Yeah.
It's literally on a swamp. It's sinking. There's billions in deferred maintenance for that. And so, look, there's a commitment to continue to revitalize the National Mall. And I do truly believe that all of the jurisdictional partners, however, believe that an NFL draft can put our nation's capital and can put the mall itself, like, really back on the mind in front of Americans. I mean, 14 million people watched night one of the draft.
That's crazy. I know.
14 million people.
I know.
More than every NHL playoff broadcast combined in the first round.
It would be
the NFL draft.
Be an absolute zoo if it were here. It would be fun, though, and it would be great for the city. Thanks. Not just for coming on the show today. I always appreciate that. But thank you for everything you did to make this happen. For those that are listening, Joe was a significant reason why this team appears to be headed back to D.C. He was the point person for the team for several years. He was significantly involved in getting that federal land back to the control of the city, which, if that doesn't happen, we never have what we have right now. I'm sure Monday was a day for you to celebrate as well. So congratulations. Thanks. I'm sure we'll be talking soon. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right, that is it for the day. Chris is out. Linnell's in. He's up next.
All right, last night, the Washington Capitals closed out the Montreal Canadiens 4-1. Alex Ovechkin scored his 40th career playoff power play goal, and Brandon Duhaime scored the empty netter to seal it. They will face Carolina in round two. Last night, a Pittsburgh Pirates fan fell 21 feet over the Roberto Clemente wall and onto the warning track. Umpires called a halt to the contest while EMS and training staff tended to him as players looked visibly shaken. He remains in critical condition at Allegheny General Hospital. The Timberwolves beat the Lakers last night to close out their series 103-96. Rudy Gobert had 27 points, 24 rebounds, and 2 blocks. They will face the winner of Warriors-Rockets. Last night, the Nats fell to the Phillies 7-2. Jake Irvin pitched 6 innings, gave up 8 hits, and 6 earned runs. The Nats fall to 13-18. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980 and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and to turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.